Now, last time I said that the matters in the north of Europe were different than they were in Italy. The social and political structure in the north of Europe was still medieval, where Italy already had this kind of urban complexion. The attitudes in the north of Europe towards life were different, at least, than the attitudes of the humanists in the south, which we talked about last time. Now, the Reformation was a northern affair, not a southern affair. And the Reformation can only be understood against this kind of background. And it was a movement which was made possible, at least at first, by the type of religious life which we have in the north, the type of religious life both of the common people, as far as we know about it, and of the intellectuals of the north. For that type of religious life is crucial. For remember that when we talk about religious life, we talk about all of life, because all of their attitude towards life were formulated in these terms. Now, I've talked to you already in one of the first lectures about what life was like in Europe in 1500. And that I must recall to you. It was beset with catastrophes. It tended to go into millenarian and prophetic directions. Moreover, and this I must add, what would have struck you about this life most, if any of you were suddenly transported back, was, I suppose, its general violent tenor. Calamities and catastrophes were much more afflicting than at present, more difficult to guard against. It was a time, as all primitive times, of violent contrast between illness and health and misery and wealth and grandeur and poverty. Moreover, everything was of a kind of proud and cruel publicity. Lepers would sound their rattles, beggars exhibited their deformities, and all of that sort of thing. So that it was public, it was violent, it was frightening, and this is why all the many millenarian reactions. It was, in other words, a primitive society, one that feasted also on displays, something we shall come back to in a minute. The displays were, remember, not only the processions of the great, but also executions, which provided food for the mind of the common people, as I told you before. Now, all this violent kind of life has a bearing upon the religious picture, because not surprisingly, in a primitive society like this, religious life was equally violent, still occupied with medieval symbolism, untouched, of course, by the Italian Renaissance. And it must not surprise you either that this kind of primitive life, these kind of natural catastrophes which you couldn't guard against in those days, had a kind of preoccupation with death, which will haunt us throughout this semester, a preoccupation with death which shades into the macabre. Cemeteries were the meeting places of people, the charnel house. Burial was only 9 days, then your bones were thrown into a charnel house. And shops were established before these charnel houses. In other words, death and life intermingled, as it has not intermingled in the modern period. Nowadays, death is brushed aside. And as you know, in American society, if you've been to Forest Lawn in Los Angeles, you're supposed to smile and forget about it. But this kind of American trauma did not actually exist in those days. Death and life intermingled, and this is important for you to understand, just as the fears of the natural catastrophes intermingled with the violent tenor of life. And this constant presence of death in one way or another, symbolically or otherwise, meant, of course, an emphasis on Christian salvation, that salvation was a constant concern. They lived, as I've told you once before, in the constant expectation not only of their own death, but of the end of the world. Luther lived in such an expectation. And therefore you have this almost frantic quest for salvation. This plays into the quest for the millennium, that quest which was such a revolutionary dynamic of pre-industrial times. And you will see this kind of atmosphere repeated even in modern times in backward regions in Europe, in Sicily, in parts of Spain, in all of these. This kind of millennium ideas, this quest for salvation, this belief in the end of the world, this belief that you have to prepare for the coming of Christ, a just society, that is an equal society where everybody is equal, that this kind of idea in this kind of heightened manifestation was to cause Luther, as you know already, a great deal of trouble. It goes directly into what we call the Radical Reformation. It breaks out continually when the existing order is shattered. It broke out in the Reformation. It broke out, as you will see, in the English Revolution. The revolts throughout our period are animated by that spirit, by this what you call primitive rebels, it's been called. But they're only primitive from a modern, don't know how much more sophisticated revolutionary point of view. They are primitive because they believed in the immediacy of the utopia, because they believed in it in Christian framework, in the apocalypse, in all the things that I have told you about it. Therefore, some modern revolutionaries have called them, with some injustice if you look at themselves, primitive rebels. Now, the first lesson which is learned from this is, of course, that this quest of salvation, this kind of thing, was always combined then with a longing for a better world. Not only in the next world, but here. The second consequence of importance is this. The search for salvation, the preoccupation of death and violence, tended to go in for something else, almost opposed, which we might call religious safeguards. On the one hand, in a rather primitive way, you could strike out, use the Bible and use this millenarianism to build a better world. But in another way, you could go in, and this the mass of men did, for religious safeguards, and that must occupy us for a minute. For we have, before the Reformation, the increasing religious processions and ever greater store set by outward religious customs, by outward observance. Thus it is, at the beginning of the 16th century, that so many houses in Europe are covered with images of saints. Now, the church always taught that you render saints and holy relics their due, but the worship of saints and holy relics has God as its object and not the saint or the holy relic. But in the popular mind, in this atmosphere, this was soon blunted. Saints tended to become regarded with superstition. They tended to become familiar figures. We now have paintings of saints dressed in the costume of the time. And familiarity tried to induce abuse and, in a sense, a kind of superstition. For example, we see a king of France, Louis XI, distributing the ribs of St. Louis, a very important saint, distributing the ribs at St. Louis at a banquet. His favorites each got a whole rib, and the bishops had to divide one between. St. Louis also ground up holy relics and took them as a kind of medicine. This is the kind of extreme that you get in this kind of quest for a religious safeguards. Such saints and relics tended to become devoid of mystery. They tended to become less religious objects and objects of superstition. They were treated with a kind of, they were endowed with kind of godlike powers. Now, to be sure, this kind of popular dynamic needed something to objectify it, something to cling on to, something tangible and personified. Thus, even in the Middle Ages, when a particularly holy man died, like St. Thomas of Aquinas, his body is immediately boiled in order to get clean bones, which become relics. This does become a kind of fetishism, if you like, but which it is really is a quest for making tangible the ideas which seem to be the truth. Mass meetings in these days, but I can't go into that, save the same purpose. To be tangible for ideas which seem to be the truth, to objectify them, to make them tangible, through tangible symbols, which you can see, which you can grasp, which actually, in a way, exist. Now, long before the Protestant reformers spoke out, there was protest against this worship of saints and relics from within the church itself. One great scholar said in the 15th century, there is no virtue which is more neglected in these miserable times than discretion. And that was certainly true. Now, what I want you to notice about this is that the church was not responsible for this. It was an abuse. But where the church failed, in a way, was in overindulgence with the populace, in overindulgence, in not doing anything about it. And this overindulgence led in the end to a very sharp reaction against all of this, as you might easily see. And that reaction was led, of course, by the reformers. For in a sense, the church was being overloaded. Perhaps that's the best way I can put it. Too many earthly blessings were expected. Saints were supposed to stave off all evil. Pilgrimages were to bring success in the world. Masses were said about everything. There was a mass to find lost property. There was even a mass, a mass which was said for the living so that they might drop dead, a mass against your enemies. In other words, with all this proliferation of what you might call the exuberance, if you like, because much of it will remain, of popular religion, with all this exuberance, the distinction between spiritual and temporal was to be all but obliterated in the popular mind. Everything seemed to go into each other. Death and life, saints and superstitions, everything, religious safeguard and the millennial urge, all this seemed to get to flow into each other. Now, this religious ferment then meant these things by and large. A quest for certainty of salvation, which led to the abuse of church doctrine. It led to a kind of formalizing of religion until the distinction between spiritual and temporal seemed all but obliterated. And it led, of course, to a continuing millenarian dynamic. The position of the church in all of this was that it was, first of all, too indulgent. The Catholic Reformation will try and do something about it, as you will see. Secondly, it was being overloaded. This is the background of the prime accusation of the reformers, that faith was submerged in works. What they meant when Luther and the others said that faith was submerged in works was very simply all the things that I have told you. What they meant is really abuses, that faith was submerged in works, that the spiritual and temporal had become entangled with each other, that outward things were more important than what Luther was to call faith freely found. The reformers, of course, confused the abuse with the reality, but reformers are up to do that in any case. Now, did that all mean that with the people, the church stood in high repute? Well, here I won't say much because you will read it in the Reformation book. It did not, of course, because the church had lost contact with this popular religious ferment, as you know from your reading. It had lost contact through the condition of the clergy, which was bad. It had lost contact through the fact that the bishops had become administrators and were not really any more involved in the cure of souls. That they had become administrators and had lost contact, as administrators do, had lost contact, and even one person could hold, as you know from your reading, many bishoprics. Therefore, the clergy were in contempt. And there is that North German poem, which I think I cite in the book, which says, if the blind lead the blind, all will be damned. And that was a serious accusation, because where was the clergy in this quest for salvation? Where was that clergy in these evil times? Making money and administrating was, by and large, the response. So that, on the whole, the church had lost touch, and touch in a very dangerous way. So what took the place of the church? What took the place of the church? New religious orders. And above all, one new Catholic religious order from the previous century, whom we call the friars. The friars caused lots of trouble to the administrators. They didn't like them, because the friars were clergy who went around and preached at street corners. Friars who went in for emotional preaching at street corners, really. Who went around and preached wherever they could find people. They didn't have what you would call a parish or a diocese. They preached at street corners all over. They emphasized preaching. They drew vast crowds. And their preaching was highly emotional. But it was, of course, within the church that it was Catholic preaching. But highly emotional Catholic preaching of these friars. Now, why do I make so much of it? Because it is in the guise of friars that the Protestants first appeared. When the Protestant reformers first tried to conquer a province or a territory, they were, for the populace, undistinguishable from the friars. And the way they worked, if you like, their revolutionary action, is that they appeared just as the friars did. And then they went further and further. But they appeared to the general populace as the friars they had known for such a long time. And then they swayed crowds and they captured cities. But they began swaying crowds and capturing cities, by and large, as friars. That was their technique. Now, this kind of popular piety laid the groundwork of the Reformation in two ways. First of all, through the excessive formalization of religious expression, which led to this reaction. Secondly, through the attacks on the clergy, which had lost touch with what was happening, as you will read. And thirdly, I should say, of course, through the ferment itself. Through the ferment itself. Now, so much for popular piety, but what about the intellectuals? And here we must again come to the intellectuals, because in those days it wasn't really a problem, and I must make that clear to you. Today it's a problem. You ask yourself, am I an intellectual, am I not? Answer is probably no, I don't know, maybe yes. Today it's a problem, you don't know what it meant. 16th century, quite clear. A separate class, for few people went to university. Few people went for university. Few people became scholars. Very few. And so the intellectuals were a definite class, like the humanists in Italy and the humanists in the North. Now, we've seen something about the intellectuals in Italy. What about the intellectuals in the North? What about them? The Northern intellectuals also benefited from the spirit of the Renaissance. It had percolated North in education. And so the education these Northern intellectuals had was a Renaissance humanist education, as I have described it to you, mainly centered upon the classics, on the rejuvenating spirit of the classics, all these things I've described to you anyway before. And so the intellectuals in the North came from this kind of education. But the difference was that once they got out of the colleges, and even in the colleges to a certain extent, they were captured by this religious atmosphere that I have talked about. And therefore they applied their learning to Christian concerns, and not to use the classics to revival. After all, you know, intellectuals weren't that far removed in these days. I mean, the ivory tower intellectual has never really existed. Anything is political. Everything you do is political. Everything is in society. So it's rather foolish to talk about the ivory tower intellectual. He was usually, in European history, a rightist conservative in attitude. But he was hardly an ivory tower intellectual in any sense. So these intellectuals lived in this atmosphere, where, as I told you, death and life intermingled this way. And there was none of that sharp division, where life was public, where you had this kind of violent tenor of life. So of course they were caught up in this Christian atmosphere and in the atmosphere of this Christian concerns. And so they did two things, and I just repeat them briefly because you will read about it. They applied learning to Christian sources of antiquity, the church fathers, the New Testament. And why? Because they also wanted to renew their society. But they thought their society could be renewed through the ancient sources of Christianity, their society could not be renewed to the ancient sources of classics. And so they didn't want so much pure Cicero, but they wanted the pure church fathers, the New Testament purified of later accretions, the literature of Christianity to have it pure. And why, again, to purify society? What did this mean? Secondly, because they wanted to get out of the bind. They wanted to renew society. And from their point of view, this meant, quite clearly, getting rid of the superstitions that I've talked about, getting rid of this confusion of temporal and spiritual, getting rid of these primitive elements, if you like, in the religious scene of the times, which I've just described. And so going back to the sources meant criticism of the church, which had lost touch and had lost leadership. It meant trying to discover a Christianity which, to use your terms, would be more relevant than what was happening. They were mistaken, it was not, but they tried. It was more relevant to Christianity than the kind of superstition and millennium of the people themselves. And so, as Erasmus put it very simply, and you can remember this, my aim, he said, is to lead man back to Christ. What did Erasmus mean when he said to lead man back to Christ? It meant to lead man back to a purified Christianity, to a Christianity of the church fathers before the Middle Ages, like the Italian humanists, the Middle Ages were condemned before the Middle Ages, and to lead it back to a Christianity that could get people out of the bind of fear and superstition and millenarian ideas, that could get them back, as these intellectuals thought, to something very essential in Catholic theology, reason. For like all intellectuals, through their education in Italy and the North, they stressed reason and the rational approach. Erasmus says, what is an intellectual? An intellectual is one who does not make decisions lightly. What he meant, an intellectual is one who applies reason to his decision, who sees all sides and then comes to a judgment. That, for Erasmus, was an intellectual, who sees all sides and then comes to a judgment, who uses reason and does not jump into utopia. It's a good definition. So that what you have, therefore, is this definition of Erasmus, of an intellectual. And like their fellow intellectuals in Italy, like the humanists in Italy, they wanted to introduce rationalism into this situation. And the only way they thought they could introduce rationalism in this situation, judgment and rationalism into this situation, was by stressing the sources of Christianity, going back to the sources, forgetting about prophecy and millenarianism and all of that, but going to the sources, examining the New and the Old Testament, and getting it pure, and getting it, as it were, right from their point of view. Now, what did this mean? It meant something, again, of the greatest importance. For these northern humanists were bound to be men of moderation. This is clear. If you believe in reason, you're bound to be a man of moderation. So they were bound to be men of moderation. They had no sympathy for violence. Obviously, they wanted to cut through this bind. They had no sympathy for the violence of popular piety. They had no sympathy for Martin Luther, who was so close to popular piety and whose own nature was similarly stormy. This ideal of moderation held the northern humanists within the church in the end. For they believed, as part of moderation, in dialogue, and not in a way in the kind of activism that you have above all at first in the Lutheran Reformation, as you will see. They thought that they were best equipped to reform the church, but they also thought that the reform of the church must come gradually and through an elite. Because what did they say to the common people by and large? They said to the common people something the Italian intellectuals said too, that the good life, the truth, is in the last resort a matter of culture and learning. The Northern humanists said, in effect, that you can only come to a true Christianity through learning. You've got to go back to the sources. You've got to know the sources. So you can really only come to the truth through learning. And you can only, therefore, be, in a sense, a man of reason through learning. And so these humanists exalted learning as the road to culture, the learning as the road to truth, and as somebody said it, they believed, and this is true, that the learned would go to heaven. They shared with the Southern humanists, with the Italian humanists, therefore, the faith in education. And presumably, if you had the right kind of education and learning, you could read the New Testament in the original and the Church Fathers, this would renew you and would give you the strength to resist the millenarianism and all this kind of fear that went around. And this strength would in the end make you go to heaven, as it were. Now, why do I stress it? Not only because I like it, which I obviously do. Of all the theories we are going to deal with, this seems to me the only sensible one. Now, why do I stress it? Because it became politically very important. Now, why did it become politically important? Because these humanists became the advisors of bishops, the advisors of princes. And as advisors, they said to the bishops and princes, when Luther appeared, take it easy. Take it easy. Try to finesse it. String him along. He's not so bad. Maybe he'll come back. No violence, no open break. These people made Lutheranism possible. Because we have the astonishing thing that after all, don't forget, or you will never remember, so you can't forget, that Luther was excommunicated in 21. 20 years later, bishops and cardinals and good Catholics were still negotiating with him. Just ignored it, that he was being excommunicated. And this was the policy of the humanists, the policy of moderation and conciliation. They misread the Protestant Reformation very badly, because those 20 years gave Lutheranism a chance to get hold. This moderation gave Lutheranism a chance to get going. If they had really enforced the Pope's excommunication in 21, they would have utterly destroyed Lutheranism. Very little doubt about it. They could have utterly destroyed it. But they didn't act at once. They said reason and moderation, and the guy will come back, and he isn't so bad, and so on. Well, don't read this into modern things, because, you know, things change, because I see the look on you that already I'm going to apply this to the University of Wisconsin. Because there would be otherwise lessons to be drawn from this. But I don't mean it that way at all, because conditions change. You can make of it whatever you like. But it is quite true that these intellectuals, in a way, did a great disservice to the Catholic Church. Sure, no doubt about it. Because they introduced indecision. And when you confronted the revolution of the Reformation, and you confronted it with indecision, you were, as we would say, lost. And they were lost. If you negotiated 20 years beyond the revolution, you really helped to establish it. Therefore, we must summarize this part by saying the humanists never broke with the church. They stayed within it. But in staying within it, it is doubtful whether they did it in the end much of a service. They stressed learning rather than dogma. Erasmus has a wonderful saying, the greatest enemy of humanity is the dogmatist. There is, I think, something to that. They were against dogmatism, and they believed in faith, but their faith was a highly intellectualized faith. But their humanism never remained, as the Italian humanism, a Sunday dress. Now, to be sure, They didn't penetrate to among the people. That is clear. Everything I have said must make it clear to you that this is a very intellectualized thing. He didn't penetrate, but they became politically very important because of the position they occupied in society as really the guider, the people who guided the princes, the bishops, and in a sense, you might say, the great of this world. The intellectuals in this way reacted to the violent tenor of popular religious expression by stressing discretion and moderation, by turning to learning rather than outward religious safeguards. But in so doing, they injected into the age an element of hesitation, indecisiveness, which I said is very important. They also, of course, and I shall have to come back to that, injected into the age an element of toleration. You'll see, Charles V, when we come to him, the emperor who reigned during all this time, was a humanist, educated by the humanists. He never really understood Martin Luther. Fanaticism was quite beyond his understanding. But he also, for example, was tolerant. Tolerant. He gave the Jews the most liberal patent then in existence. Tolerant. Toleration enters into this kind of humanism as well. Now, Martin Luther did not come from such a background. He came instead from the background of popular piety. His intense concern for salvation, first accepting and then rejecting religious safeguards, is typical. His final idea, sola fide, salvation alone, cut through the dilemma of the search for security, the search for salvation, and really the insecurity of clinging to outward signs. Not fear, but trust, cut through the kind of ideas and the kind of popular piety that I have talked about. And yet, there are two final things to mix you up still more. First of all, the intellectuals themselves weren't so removed from the popular ferment as it seems. Many of them believed in these superstitions. Many of them believed in signs and in portents. Many of them dabbled in alchemy to discover the secrets of the universe. Many believed in the battle between the devil, for it is nature that is involved here, and the signs and portents of nature were, after all, the sight portents of God. What do you do when a man like Erasmus believes that indeed, in a part of the world, fishes were found who had the heads of popes, women who gave birth to donkeys or pigs or worse, rains made out of drops of blood. The battle between God and the devil in nature was everywhere. And even a man like Erasmus, Melanchthon, man of reason and learning, believed in these portents and signs. There they were not very far. You are not surprised that later on millenarians believed in it, because the Puritans, of course, believed in it. If you know anything about early American history, if you read the early diaries of the early Puritans in America, there were more calves born with double heads instead of children than anything else, because they were born to heretics. Now, the second thing is, first of all, they didn't stand aside so much. They didn't stand aside too much. To them, too, nature was sentient. To them, too, nature was the transmission belt of the eternal battle between God and the devil. And to them, too, nature had that function. But secondly, in the end, you have another feature which is of some importance to us. Namely, in the end, that popular piety just wouldn't lie down. How can I illustrate that to you? Very easily. When the Protestants abandoned much of this color, and if you might call superstition, the saints, the worship of relic, the outward religious safeguards, when the Protestants abolished it and whitewashed the churches and abolished processions and all of this, didn't work. People streamed from Protestant to Catholic regions for religious processions. They streamed to Catholic regions to worship saints, though they weren't supposed to do so, of course. And many of them, there were great battles in Protestant regions about the populace who wanted to cover their houses with images of saints and did all of these kind of things. In other words, though the Protestants did their best to cut through this kind of popular culture. It was awfully difficult to them. To be sure, in some region they were more successful than in others. But by and large, wherever you have a border region in the end, between Protestant and Catholic regions in Europe, you will find Protestants streaming over to take part in all the Catholic ceremonial. Because in the end, the church didn't stop it, really. It tried to. You will see the Council of Trent tried to. But it couldn't really stop it very much. And so in the end, you have all of this. The popular piety goes on. These ideas that I have tried to describe to you go on. And the Protestants had a very difficult time in defeating them. And the only country where they half managed to do it successfully was England. But there they had a revolution to do it with. In the rest of Europe, this was not really so successful. We must therefore come to one very fundamental fact, finally, that the popular culture, which so much influenced Martin Luther, the popular culture which was so important all the way through for the revolutionary dynamic of the millenarians and all of that sort of thing, that popular culture goes on. It goes on. Sometimes it breaks out as a revolutionary thing, like in the English Revolution, where like in the Reformation, as you will see, in the Radical Reformation, and it breaks out again in the English Revolution. But it goes on and on and on. And even in an age of industrialism, it will break out again in the underdeveloped parts of Europe, in Sicily, in northern Italy, in southern Italy, and in Spain. It will go on and on. Therefore, we must finally summarize the main features. It is confusing because it is confusing. First of all, chaos is always confusing. Volatile ideas are always confusing. And I can't make them neat for you because they were singularly untidy. That's what the humanists, after all, objected to. First of all, in this popular piety, a heightened sense of salvation, a heightened quest for salvation. That must be clear. We have many things where people yelled when the priest held the chalice, "Higher, sir, priest, higher." And by the way, I have to mention things like the host and the chalice and the mass. Don't be afraid. If you don't know what a mass is, ask in sections. I can't take time out now. But ask in sections if you don't know what it is, because you'd better know what it is. So that on the whole you have this kind of thing, the quest for salvation. But secondly, this quest for salvation in the atmosphere which I have described couldn't just be a quest for life after death. Death was too close. Life was too chancy. You also transposed it to your present insecure existence. And here it went then, secondly, either into the urge of millenarianism, and apocalyptic ideas, revolutionary ideas of that period, very, inchoate revolutionary ideas. There's nothing of revolutionary tactics or strategy. This is what we call these days instant utopia. Christ will come back again, and he'll come back in the right society, and that's it. It's looking backward to paradise before the fall. That is technically what they look backward to. To return to innocence, a return to innocence. Shouldn't be too unfamiliar. A return to innocence, to paradise before the fall. We'll hear more about it. And secondly, it could go to this religious superstition, to safeguards, to what the reformers were to call with good justice, the worship of relics and the worship of saints. The worship of relics, the worship of saints, indulgences as part of a lottery, all of this sort of thing, the abuse and the quest for religious safeguards. Now, it is out of such a background that Martin Luther came. His parents, unlike the parents of Calvin — the parents of Calvin were good urban bourgeois, highly educated — the parents of Martin Luther were of peasant stock, peasants who had become owners of a small mine, a small coal mine in Thuringia. Coal mining was the most dangerous occupation. Coal mine in Thuringia. And therefore, while they were no longer peasants, they came, and Luther's whole early upbringing was definitely in a kind of peasant society. And in that kind of thought, which was the thought among peasants, the thought among the unlearned. and Luther's parents were unlearned, among the unlearned. And it is from that background that Luther developed then his ideas, though he did get eventually, as you will see, an excellent humanist education, probably the best humanist education Germany had to offer. He eventually got in the Augustinian order, but before he got that education, and his whole early development is close to this kind of popular piety. And Martin Luther, then, we shall go on Wednesday.